We'll be out of here by 1:30.
Okay, we're going to call to order the House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Services, Tuesday, May 12th. We have several overviews we'll be doing, and the order we'll hear these in will be the overview of the new and emerging communication technologies, followed by the shockwave surviving North America's biggest disaster, and then third will be the overview of Tualatin Valley Water District disaster planning efforts. So if we could please have first up from AT&T, Elise Brown, followed by from Solutions Engineer with Sprint Nextel, Kenneth Blaney, and Government Account Manager from Verizon Wireless, Bob Fletcher. Would you like to do them all three together?
Yes.
Yeah.
That'd be great. And we'll start with you, Elise.
I'm going to say a few words first and then, okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Elise Brown representing AT&T today, and unfortunately, I had hoped to have Dan Yeomans here with AT&T to do our presentation, but you're stuck with me today as he was unable to be here. I was hoping to have my colleagues sit here, too, because what I'm going to do is show you a video that's been produced by AT&T, and don't frown. It's only about 4 minutes, but it's a great way to tee up the discussion today about providers like AT&T and Sprint and Verizon that are here today, and how this is a demonstration of how we're working with our local communities in times of disasters. So what you're going to see on the video is just one case study. Again, it's a national video, and it's featuring Hurricane Gustav. And it shows the type of equipment and technicians that we put out in the field to restore communications. So here, it looks like I'm being preempted by the video.
We make sure that they got meals. We make sure they got water. We make sure that they got fuel. They got all the things they need to make sure we put our customers back in service as quick as possible.
People that work for AT&T, if they see someone that needs a hand doing something, they'll get out there and help them do that.
Sure, it's going to take a few weeks to get everything, you know, back to perfect, but I know we're all going to try as hard as we can.
Put in a sweet symbol.
It's a big help to these people. Another example of AT&T being an excellent corporate citizen.
Thank you for AT&T for letting me call my family.
Well, I don't know what I'd do without it right now.
I think AT&T did a fantastic job in bringing people not only from here, but I met people from all over the country that came in here and helped and really did a fantastic job.
We had engineers from Mobile, Alabama.
San Antonio, the Dallas area.
You're from Chattanooga, and how many guys came down?
We brought a total of 32.
Call went out for volunteers to help out with the hurricane evacuees, so I was glad to help.
You know, it isn't what you say, it's what you do. And AT&T, in this crisis, was phenomenal.
There was never a question of whether or not people would be there for the other people that were in need. And this was just a public demonstration of how close of a family we have at AT&T.
We take real pride in the network here. And been here at the office since Monday morning, living in the trailer out in the parking lot. But getting back to work here and helping the firefighters and the National Guard and the police, that's really important to all of us here.
Honestly, all of us down here who have been affected by it really appreciate what everybody's done.
If you were able to talk to the head of AT&T, the boss himself, what would you say about what you experienced here with the AT&T?
Well, he might not like it, but I'd probably kiss him.
If something were to happen today or tomorrow, AT&T would be there to help us in every way.
We have only 2 employees in Greensburg, and as soon as they made sure their families were safe, both Ed and Melissa turned their attention to our company and to our customers.
Michael Moore, we've got to get down to the central office and see what's going on and what we can do and everything.
I walked outside to see how bad the damage was, and 3/4 of my roof is gone. And then I thought,
I better walk down to the office to see how it is.
The next day, I couldn't believe the crews had come in. Switchman people from everywhere, cable people, engineers, supervisors. I just can't believe why people have been working. Just absolutely trying to get things going.
I want to say thank you to two outstanding Kansans who are AT&T employees for their efforts to keep emergency communications functioning. I'm grateful that AT&T focuses rapid restoration efforts on small communities with the same urgency they focus on our bigger cities.
One of the things that AT&T values is working together in a coordinated manner to respond to the disaster. So you saw a lot in that video, the interaction between government agencies and utilities and the businesses involved. And one of our key partners is our engineers that work cooperatively with the other carriers. And I'll get to an example of that in just a second. So that's the national example. I think we're all very familiar with what happened in our very own state back in the fall of 2007 with the great floods here in Oregon. AT&T responded to the flooding and windstorm of fall 2007 by deploying more than 20 generators to cell sites, keeping them up and running, and we established cellular on wheels, we call those COWs, at Camp Relay, Riley Military Base, located just south of Astoria. And we also provided cell phones for those in need, and which is a typical thing, both emergency responders and citizens who needed to contact their family members. And the example, as I say, working with fellow carriers, apparently during the storm, the Verizon landline switch was knocked out. And so there's where many of the communication challenges arose. So we all work closely with Verizon to provide wireless communications during this time. And I think that they'll probably address that in their presentation. AT&T has a comprehensive written disaster recovery plan, and we conduct tabletop exercises on a regular basis. Also, the Network Operations Center that monitors our network for the western region of the United States is located in Redmond, Washington. So we offer any of you at any time to come and tour the facility if you'd like to. We've invited Rep. Cowan to do that earlier. The bottom line is that we put a great deal in time of energy and resources into preparing for emergencies. So I thought the video was a great demonstration of that. And some of the other resources that we can bring to bear, each of our companies, is the financial resources. Also, to assist in Oregon, AT&T at the time of the flood relief effort donated $25,000 to the American Red Cross. So that's just another example of the partnerships, public and private, that are happening across the country and here in Oregon. So happy to be here today just to demonstrate one example of that. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Ms. Brown, and you must be very proud to represent a company when you see them on the screen performing those duties out there.
Thank
you. And that's for all our technological and communication folks. We really appreciate what you bring in times of disaster. I think what we'd like to do, if the committee's okay, is maybe we just hold questions for now and we continue on with the presentation.
That's fine.
And I appreciate that. Also, for those of you just tuning in, our chair and several members are currently testifying in other committees. They will be back, so don't worry. Nothing's going to change. We'll continue to move forward, as we have in this committee. But I do appreciate you being here today. Thank you.
Certainly.
And next up, we could have Kenneth Blaney from Sprint Nextel, Solutions Engineer. And also, if Mr. Fletcher, if you want to join him, you're welcome to do so as well. Bob Fletcher, Government Account Manager with Verizon Wireless. And you start whenever, and please identify yourselves for the record.
So I'm Kenneth Blaney, with Solutions Engineer with Sprint Nextel, and thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Bob Fletcher, Government Account Manager for Verizon Wireless.
And I think we'll start off with a Sprint PowerPoint and go through some of our emergency response team initiatives.
And I believe our committee assistants got that all geared up for you. Thank you, Debbie, for everything you do, and David as well. Great job.
Hey, Nick, did you say you weren't going to present, right?
No, Bob's going to present.
Okay, all right, good.
So, again, thank you for the opportunity to present today and giving us a chance to discuss how Sprint partners with our public sector clients and how we deploy solutions in emergency response situations. And I'll go through some of our highlights here and try to keep it non-salesy. So, also at the end, I'll touch on a little bit of emerging technologies and how they apply to public safety as well. So within Sprint, our emergency response team is our internal group that really coordinates our emergency responses, much like the AT&T video had, to disasters, natural disasters, man-made disasters, whatever is going on with, you know, a critical response anywhere in the nation. And they have a couple of three key pillars to what our emergency response team is all about, our ERT team. So one is their mission, and their mission is really to partner with our customers to provide assistance during response. It's to get our network up and running, but also to partner with our public safety clients to help them to deploy public services in response to disaster. Second is their team. Much of the team is made up of ex-public safety and military personnel, so very familiar with disaster response, command and control type of scenarios. And third is their role. What they're there to do during a disaster is coordinate our equipment deployment, our personnel equipment, our personnel deployment, our infrastructure response, and to facilitate interagency communication between our clients and within our company. So the way we look at communication elements, continuity of communication elements during a disaster, to make sure that you're, prepared and ready for an event, we look at our solutions if they're rapid and they're mobilized. So are they designed for urban or rural environments? Can you deploy them to inner city or to out-of-the-way areas? And these are all things that we advise, again, our public sector clients and partners to look at when planning for emergency response. Are they self-contained? So much like the AT&T video, we call our cell on wheels SATCULTs, so satellite backhaul cell on light trucks. Can you get them out to the field quickly? And can you deploy personnel to support that equipment and that infrastructure? Second, we look at interoperability. So across geographies, across jurisdictions, and across agencies. Proven, trusted, reliable. So is your solution proven, trusted, reliable, basically? Is it tested in the environment that you expect to deploy it in? Is it going to be ready and scalable for the situation that it arises? Flexible. So oftentimes you'll have a situation where it needs to integrate with existing infrastructure. So can you do that? Will it integrate with additional personnel coming from out of the area that need to take a part of it? Scalable. So again, back to, is it regional, nationwide coverage? And applications and services, kind of the last component we look at. Will it integrate with existing GPS, emergency operations center type of deployments within our public sector clients? So our ERT assets, really the key on this slide is that you have dedicated assets waiting to be deployed. So you're not trying to identify equipment, personnel, tools, process procedures at a time of emergency, but really how do you plan on that before the situation arises? So that's the takeaway, you know, I like from this slide is we really do have a dedicated resource of assets within our organization ready to deploy. And that's again, something we advise our clients to look at as well, dedicated resources. So much like the AT&T video, really the takeaway from this slide, you know, the recent ERT-supported events from Sprint Nextel's perspective, you know, the major hurricanes, national events, there's a Washington, D.C. Sniper shooting, Columbia shuttle response, the political conventions. More local here was Top Off 4, the tabletop that we had about 2 years ago. Olympic track and field trials down in Eugene were a response to that. And the 2008-2009 floods and Biscuit Fire down in Southern Oregon. So, you know, again, it kind of goes back to, are your solutions proven, trusted, reliable? Have they met the test of being deployed in a real-life environment? And then what do you learn from that and take away from that? So as a review, and this again, this is what we look at internally and what we work with our clients on what they should look at when designing their own solutions, is define the scope. So what's the geography you're looking at? Are you looking at city, county, state reach? And then also the scope amongst the agencies you're looking at, local agencies, state agencies, and then oftentimes federal agencies will be involved. So you need to plan for that. Identify communication single points of failure, so both from a technological perspective, do you have single data centers, stationary emergency operation centers? How do you plan for those to be out of service and out of communication? And also personnel. So you need to address, is it just one department you're relying on, one role, one person being present? Without that agency or entity, are your procedures and protocols going to be able to be deployed and kick off and be successful? Third, what we advise our clients is really partner with national carriers like Sprint, Verizon, AT&T. Utilize ARC networks kind of as a view of outsourced network operations and support. Don't reinvent the wheel entirely. Utilize us as a partner. Sprint, including my partners here, we have active rapid deployment response teams, so they can be contracted, retained on service, which I have a case study in here for the state of Virginia. They have a contract with us similar to this where they can be held on contract, rapidly deployed in response. Design your process and your protocols and design the hierarchy of command, what you're going to do for different types of events. The last two, implement and train. So, again, you know, kind of go back to, is it going to meet the needs of a situation, and test. So they can only go so far. A paper plan will only carry out so far. Really give it a test through tabletop, through Top Off 4, and then partner with, again, the carriers to see in their real-life examples how has it been, how's the response held up within some of the natural disasters we've all been through. So on wireless priority service, this is a great example of, from a technical viewpoint, we want to make sure that our public sector clients are taking advantage of technologies and solutions that are out there. So this is a great example. It's mandated and moderated actually by the National Communication Systems, NCS. So it's a prioritized access back to the wireless network during a time of disaster. So for executive leadership, military command, public health and safety, public services, utilities, disaster recovery, if all the networks are congested, kind of the Southern California had an earthquake in the last 12 months, everybody feels the earthquake, everybody grabs their home phone, their office phone, their cell phone, and calls somebody and says, did you feel the earthquake? Well, with all that cell phone traffic, you get, you know, congestion on the network that the emergency first responders cannot get access to the network. With wireless priority service, it's a technology in place that gives those first responders first access to the wireless air channel to get the business going, to get the response going for the public safety. So definitely we advise take advantage of existing technologies that are out there. And lastly, kind of on the existing solutions that we look at is dispatch integration. So most, you know, all public safety agencies have an emergency operations center. They have a land mobile radio system, a private RF network for police, fire, ambulance, first responders. And how do you look at expanding that scope of personnel, folks that may not warrant having a private RF handset but want to be part of that communication protocol? So that's definitely a solution that's out there today that we use internally and that we advise a lot of our public sector clients to use. One example of this is about 9 months ago, we did a joint operation with the Oregon Air National Guard up in Beaverton. So with them, Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, Washington County agencies, and with myself and a couple other Sprint folks were up there. Basically tested our handsets being interoperable to their satellite phones, to their private RF network, so to kind of enable that communication, see how it works, test the technology, so you're not doing it for the first time during a response. So that's kind of the first part is what we do today with our emergency response teams, and we want to touch briefly on emerging technologies and specifically how they apply to the public sector. A lot of these solutions apply to private sector, business, enterprise, but there's definitely an application to what we see as our public sector folks. And this is something that we're looking at within Sprint that we have deployed internally as a company, and then we're also advising our clients as an emergency technology. So this slide really highlights the evolving nature of communication. So on the left, you have wireline access. We're very familiar with that. Dedicated facilities to central offices. Very reliable, but they're dedicated facilities to just that building. Not very dynamic or flexible or mobile, obviously. And on the right, we have wireless access. So traditional, expanding that traditional wireline world and enabling remote offices, regional offices, and mobile employees, mobile EOCs to have access back into what we typically would have considered kind of the only access into the corporate, you know, agency centers, for example. So with this in place, it kind of gives the infrastructure for what we call, for part of our unified communications, our emergency technologies. So a couple of initiatives that we see that driving communications today is the need to reduce cost. So statewide, through sound investments, provide a visible return in the near term. You know, a lot of the technologies we all talk about are heavy CapEx and long-term ROI, so a little bit hard to see the immediate positive benefit to the agency. How it gains operational efficiency for your business and for first responders. Other initiatives, enable employees to work with enhanced technologies, basically to give them quicker access to emergency response tools, and an ever-increasing need to enable mobile workers. So the current trend or the current challenge, I guess I should say, within achieving those initiatives is we all have multiple communication tools. So we all have email, we have a desk phone, a mobile device, multiple voicemails. Some folks are using instant messaging, text messaging, faxes, audio, video conferencing, but all these systems are disparate. So you're checking multiple voicemails through the day. You don't know if you should reach somebody on their desk phone or their mobile phone. Are they able to check their email throughout the day? All these different systems are disparate and hard to manage from an individual user. Presence, the second one, inability to see where decision makers are at. So presence is kind of a buzzword of are they available? Are they in a meeting? Are they absolutely do not disturb or can they be reached? So updating that presence to the agency and the other members within the agency. Third or fourth really is managing complex data and multimedia. So our world has gone from kind of a static documents to how do you share dynamic data, video, and voice type of information. And then all within that is decentralized command and control. So in an emergency, you want to be able to, you know, be mobile, not just have one command and control that's centralized, that's all your resources are dependent on. And then the last one really is how do you do all that with outdated technology, legacy PBXs, legacy voice systems, multiple devices. So those are some of the challenges that we see within the marketplace today. So our view on unified communications and its benefits is it provides a single user interface to multiple systems. So first responder productivity, so single contact number, single voicemail, single client interface to voice and video conferencing, document sharing, online collaboration. So all within a laptop. We've done this within Sprint Corporate, so we're all the mobile workers are enabled with a laptop. All these tools within one laptop, one resource. Presence, we can update your status. Are you available? Are you away from your desk? Are you in a meeting? So really being able to give those folks that are guiding the command and control response to a situation visibility to the resources that are in the agency. Coordination. So with decentralized folks, you can have the solution in place across, you know, a wide geographic area, managing folks outside of one basic centralized location. I won't go into the results too much. It's more of an internal within Sprint, but there's immediate ROI on it. So it's not an expensive long-term return on investment that I mentioned earlier. And reduced carbon footprint is the added benefit. So you reduce real estate needs, reduce commuting impact, reduce power consumption on legacy systems. So there's multiple benefits to what our unified communications solutions are doing. And lastly, expand the operations and geographic reach of emergency response. So basically that's what we're kind of talking about, is taking a business tool and how do you enable it to an emergency response situation and give those folks the tools they need out in the field.
Mr. Blaney, if you could,
if
you could wrap it up in just about 2 minutes, that'd be great, and then we'll move on to Verizon.
Okay. Yeah, and this is about the last slide here. So there's just another way of taking documents that are static, maybe in a three-ring binder somewhere, kind of hard to deploy in a mobile fast response situation, get them onto off-site servers, get people access to those documents via their mobile devices, and push out that command and control, push out that communication to folks out in the field. And with that, I'll wrap it up. And in the back, in the hard copy, there's a couple of case studies, and we can go through Q&A or just review that later on.
Appreciate that. We had a bill the other day from emergency management. I heard there was some Senate testimony on regarding mapping systems for first responders.
Right.
Is there any plan or any thought that maybe somehow the software could be incorporated into what you're providing through wireless access?
Yeah, so we have a number of agencies that come to us with their emergency operations centers and their existing maps, their GIS data basically, and they want to overlay it into the GPS status of their mobile workers, whether that's through a device or through a connection card on a laptop. And we can overlay the GPS data that we can pull from our mobile devices and overlay that into kind of a central emergency operations map and visibility of where your assets and your resources are in the field.
Yeah. Great. And thank you again. And I want to
thank
let the committee know, too, that these fine folks have approached us to give this overview today, and I appreciate your time. And so next up, if we could please have Bob Fletcher, Government Account Manager with Verizon Wireless, and I will turn the gavel back over to its rightful owner, Chair Gene Cowan. Welcome back.
Thank you. I apologize for having been sidetracked today. We do have a few other presentation subjects today, so if we can going to keep this to the next few minutes. That would be terrific. I guess I'm back to being the time minder now.
Sure. Thank you, Geraldine, for the time. We need videos, about an 8-minute video, and then I'll go into about a 5-minute presentation. So I'll keep this very brief. I thank our colleagues who went before me to kind of lay the groundwork, so I want to just touch base on this real quick, and then we'll move on to the short emerging technologies after this and that. You can strip out the key on this video to see how serious, allude to again, our other colleagues from the other carriers, how serious we are about our networks and how serious disaster situations. We've been kind of fortunate here in Oregon. We have a kind of reduced visibility somewhat of disasters compared to the southeast country. But this will show you how serious the disasters out there.
If recent history has taught us anything, it's that we need to be ready for the unexpected. We've learned that these events can be devastating for any business or public agency that depends on communications.
So we totally lost email service. We just virtually lost everything, and we're really non-functional.
Every organization needs a business continuity plan to ensure vital communications with customers, employees, and support personnel. And wireless communications plays a vital role.
So we thought we were prepared, and then at the last minute we found out, oh no, we're not.
Even if your business does have a plan, is it current? Does it reflect how you operate today and incorporate the latest technologies? If your facilities are damaged or destroyed, can your enterprise and its people continue to operate remotely?
I was here during Katrina. The biggest problem we had was the ability to communicate officer to officer and then interagency. So we began to watch companies and see, all right, who's doing the best deployment, who has the best infrastructure, who do we think is going to stay up during a disaster.
Verizon Wireless invests more than $5.5 billion annually to improve network capacity and coverage across its national footprint.
So the choice of going to a Verizon Wireless system was really based on my personal experience of what I'd seen.
Reliability is in our DNA. It is central to our culture and built into everything we do every day. From network operations and customer service to business continuity and crisis management.
That reliability has been proven time and again in real-life disasters.
So we invested heavily in several hundred Verizon Wireless data cards, and I got emails from the representative, how's it going, how's it going, and all I could tell him was, it's up, it's up, it's up.
Reliability starts with the Verizon Wireless Network, a coast-to-coast voice and data network that is resilient by design, with redundant equipment, backup power, and a number of other protections. Two network operations centers monitor all cell sites and switches around the clock. They work closely with field operations teams that can be dispatched 24/7 to restore service in an emergency.
Backup power is one of the most important components of our network reliability strategy. We engineer our cell sites and our switches to run independently on backup battery power and, in most cases, dedicated generators.
Verizon Wireless also can mobilize portable cell sites to enhance coverage, often in advance of an event. These mobile cell sites enhance coverage and capacity when existing equipment is damaged, disabled, or taxed beyond capacity.
Verizon Wireless has a comprehensive business continuity strategy in place to continue our own business operations in the event of a disaster. Dedicated crisis management and business continuity teams practice year-round to ensure we are ready. They are battle-tested and are empowered to make decisions. They support not only the reliability of our wireless network, but store and call center operations, back office support, and the deployment of materials and people to a crisis when the need arises.
Just as Verizon Wireless assures the continuity of its own operations, it brings this assurance to customers so they can operate through an emergency.
Well, one of the things that we looked at is what tools were available, how do we upgrade our infrastructure from a communication standpoint, and we decided to partner with Verizon Wireless due to the capabilities that they offer us.
Verizon Wireless provides network reliability as well as wireless products and services to help businesses continue operating during a disaster or any other unexpected event that may interrupt normal business operations.
We had text messaging capability. The web features on the phone also enabled us to tell our employees where to go to get the most up-to-date information, where they could see streaming video and see what's going on real time.
Building in downtown Everett burning.
24 people work at the title company, which keeps countless documents and escrow files of hundreds of clients.
Today, not much is left of the Stewart Title office. You can barely make out equipment and furniture in the rubble.
If you burn down, can you operate the next day? How long is it going to take?
Stewart Title handles thousands of documents, but thanks to computer backups, the company says customers don't need to worry.
Other realtors who were saying there's no way they could be open, there's too much paper involved. How can they possibly get to their documents? How can they get in there? Not understanding that having access to the building next door wasn't critical to us. Having access to our data was critical.
Verizon Wireless came through, they overnighted air cards to us just to get us back and running. And it was an emotional time for me because I was like, wow. So once we got those cards, we got them to the folks who didn't have internet connection. And once we got the internet connection, we could get to all of our data. And virtually, at that point, we're operational, seamless to the client.
The access to wireless cards for employees is certainly going to be part of our plans in the future.
Companies have come to learn that if they have a wired LAN, they can use a wireless LAN on our system as a backup. With the increased reliability, speed, and efficiency, wireless is now much more cost efficient. Some customers are seeing about a 45% cost reduction by deploying wireless.
Is your organization ready for the unexpected? If disaster strikes, could you still communicate with customers and employees? Would your email work? Your business function? Does your plan include wireless communications? And do you have a partner who will be there for you all the way?
Wireless communications is an important part of any business continuity solution. And when it comes to selecting a wireless partner, it's critical to choose a company that has proven reliability time and again, keeping its network running, its operations running, and its customers connected through the worst disasters. With Verizon Wireless on your business continuity team, you'll always be ready for the unexpected.
Thank you. I am really seriously going to ask you to wrap up very quickly. We have two more presentations scheduled today also.
Sure. So that was basically an overview of what we do. I think the emergency technologies, as we move forward, you all know wireless. You see their commercials from all the carriers. You know what we're doing out there. I think the key is also take a look at all of our coverage maps to see how far-reaching the wireless carriers are as far as solutions to state agency situations and the state overall for their solutions. The wireless carriers, I know us, for example, we spend about $100 million every 18 months in this region. You combine the other carriers on that, and that's quite a spend in infrastructure going into place in the state already. So I urge you to keep up the tabs on that because your carriers right now are spending quite a bit of money every 18 months in the state to build out, deploy networks in order to create cost efficiencies. And just real quick on equipment out there, you know, we all work with the state agencies and we see trends. Note that, you know, not only we all know BlackBerries, we all know PDA devices, just note that as we move forward, laptops are getting smaller. They're getting less expensive. A lot of them are coming built in with chips already in them. So maybe in the next 12, 16 months, you're going to start seeing kind of the air card solution still be there, but go away to laptops that have chips built into them, running off the network, pulling them out in the middle of nowhere, for example, ODOT, and they're doing their job in Lake County, where there's more cows than people in some spots. So you're talking about a real big ROI, ROR, return on resources, when you have the ability to do your job just as if you're sitting at your desk in the name of cost efficiencies to the state agencies. And I thank you, everybody, for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your presentation. Now we'd like to we have more movies today for you. Dr. Vicki McConnell is here with us, and I appreciate your patience. And we're moving now to a look at Shockwaves, Surviving North America's Biggest Disaster.
Chair Cowan and committee members, for the record, I'm Dr. Doom. And
I'm always so happy to listen to your presentations.
I know, they're so cheerful, aren't they?
Oh, yes, indeed.
Well, thank you. I'm Vicki McConnell, and I'm the state geologist and the director of the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. And thank you for inviting me here today. Really, I'm just here to give, I want to just give you a couple of little thoughts to take with you as you watch this excellent presentation of one of the things that we unfortunately are famous for here, and that's very dynamic geology. And a couple of things to take with you, and then at the end I'm happy to answer questions or give you a little summary of what you see. But I am one of the people that always advocate that knowledge is power. Not knowing what's going on is not the way to operate. It's not the way to make decisions. And so I am always happy to see when there's an opportunity for us all to educate ourselves on what is really going on in the dynamic geology in the state. That dynamic system is what drives everything that we do in the state. It drives our meteorology. It drives the uses of our natural resources. It drives where we live and where we can't live. And so based on that, it's always good to have the information that you can make those good decisions on. So as I said before, if we don't learn our history, then we're doomed to repeat it. So this is a good way of looking at the long history of the state.
Thank you.
Cascadia Subduction Zone earthquake and the tsunami that will come with it will be virtually identical to the one in 2004 in Sumatra.
The Sumatra Fault is almost identical to another crack in the ocean floor along the west coast of North America. The Cascadia Fault is the same length, has produced the same magnitude 9 quakes, and the same killer waves. Cascadia will destroy on a geographic scale far larger than any of the famous California earthquakes, covering more ground than 1906 in San Francisco, wrecking more freeways, bridges, and infrastructure than any of the Los Angeles quakes. Because when Cascadia rips loose, 5 cities, from Victoria and Vancouver to Seattle, Portland, and Sacramento, will be hit all at the same time. As a broken slab of seafloor snaps loose, it will lift a mountain of seawater. When that mountain collapses, it generates a series of elliptical waves, a train of tsunamis that will tear across the Pacific for 12 hours. The West Coast, Alaska, Hawaii, Japan, Taiwan, New Zealand, Australia, all will get slammed by Cascadia's waves.
A Cascadia earthquake today is going to disrupt that global infrastructure in a way we've never seen anything happen before.
Coastal towns from Northern California to Canada will be virtually wiped out, and there'll be significant damage in all the coastal cities along there as well, all at the same time.
We are tied to Japan. We are tied to Taiwan. We are tied to the Pacific. And certainly that's true of Vancouver and Seattle. That's the main stuff coming into those ports and harbors. That's the entry point. And Cascadia is going to shut that down.
When is this likely to happen? Good question.
We may be able to narrow it down to a matter of years or decades where the probability is elevated.
I don't know that we will ever be at a point where we can forecast earthquakes to the accuracy that society would need.
Do you think prediction is ever going to be feasible?
Under certain circumstances, yes.
Well, I'll tell you something I'm absolutely sure about. The next Cascadia earthquake is one day closer today than it was yesterday.
Is there anything we can do to reduce the loss of life and property damage?
We can tell you with the technology we have today where it will be 100 feet and where it will not be 100 feet. What we don't want to have is just the assumption that it's hopeless, because it's not.
Deep underground, the lower plate snags the upper plate. They become locked together. The land above the fault gets bent out of shape as enormous stress builds up over hundreds of years. Follow the subducting plate far enough down below the continent, and you discover that the rocks melt and then boil back to the surface as a chain of volcanoes. Eventually, after hundreds of years of stress, the brittle rocks along the locked zone of the fault reach their breaking point. At magnitude 9 or higher, this is called a megathrust earthquake. In the early 90s, along the Washington coast, scientists discovered a ghost forest of ancient trees killed by salt water when a giant earthquake caused the shoreline to slump. Trenches cut through tide marshes and along riverbanks showed evidence of huge sheets of sand dumped by several large tsunamis.
I guess the tipping point, or the thing that convinced most people, was finding evidence, paleoseismic evidence, of these big earthquakes. The fact that you could see a geological deposit that really you could not explain in any other way. How did these happen other than a large earthquake?
And there were earthquake and tsunami legends passed down from elders in native villages along the coast. The stories were an important clue, but there was still no way to say exactly when the last earthquake had occurred until scientists in Japan discovered similar stories from villages along their coast. Ancient records confirmed the exact time and date 3 centuries ago when a large tsunami from Cascadia hit Japan's eastern seaboard.
When you know that one occurred at a specific time, 9 o'clock in the evening, January 26, 1700, it makes it very real.
To get a feel for just how big the 1700 quake and tsunami were, go to Crescent City, California, and dig a core sample from the tide marsh.
When we get this back from the field, what we'll do is dry the sample out so that we can actually get a lot more distinguishing characteristics of the stratigraphy that we're trying to understand here. We have this coarse sand in here, very clean sand. This represents the 1964 tsunami deposit. So it resulted in a deposit that's, like I said, about a centimeter and a half thick. And then we have this deposit here that's on the order of about 15 centimeters thick associated with the 1700 earthquake. You can see that the 1700 tsunami was a much, much larger tsunami.
Cascadia's last big event back in 1700 was a magnitude 9, nearly identical to Sumatra 2004. And it's now becoming clear to scientists that the fault could rip again at any time. scientists and civil engineers have grabbed a different set of tools to build a new model of Cascadia's wave. At Oregon State University, in a wave research basin half the size of a football field, graduate students and their professors began building a physical replica of the beach, boardwalk, and downtown core of Seaside, Oregon. They intend to use this wave tank model to test the accuracy of a computer model of the Cascadia tsunami.
What the wave tank can do is it can show you in just a matter of seconds a great deal about what really is going to happen. And then trying to put that in a computer, it's very difficult. It's very, the flow over the land and around through a forest and around buildings and all these things is very, very complicated.
But with very few large-scale wave tanks available and a long list of coastal communities anxious to know what Cascadia might do to them, the reality is that most will be forced to rely on computer simulations instead. On a wet and wind-blown summer evening in Seaside, Oregon, people gathered in a home only a stone's throw from the beach to discuss the unthinkable and to make a neighborhood survival plan.
One of the things that I heard recently was very good. You should have a pair of sturdy shoes, closed-toed sturdy shoes, gloves, preferably leather, and a hard hat under your bed at all times.
This is just kind of like a general list of what you should have in any emergency supply kit. We could totally tailor it to what your needs are. Hygiene packs, first aid kit. This is a water bag, a tarp, space blankets, purified drinking water, food. You could throw granola bars, peanut butter, tuna fish, evaporated milk, all sorts of stuff. This is just what the kit comes with.
People that have handicaps, people that are disabled, people that we could help. And I'm not talking about the city, I'm talking about neighbors, helping neighbors.
What are we going to do with our visitors that are in some of our places of business? Are we going to let them know? Are the business going to be instructed on how to tell the visitors where to go, like if you're having dinner someplace?
One of the things that we're working on and that we will be doing in the future is that we will create a little sticker that will go on the window of the different businesses. And what that means is they've gone through a certain amount of training and they've demonstrated to the committee that they've educated their employees and that the employees know what to do, how to get people to safety as best they can.
Other towns on flatter ground are not so lucky. Back at Oregon State University, the physical model of the town of Seaside is almost complete. Harry Yeh, a professor of civil engineering, is doing research on what kinds of buildings would survive a tsunami. And Patrick Corcoran is wondering whether trying to outrun a wave to reach higher ground really makes sense.
And took off running down, you know, kind of like this. You know what, if I could just stop here, if I could go up in the big building, I'm wondering if that would be a quicker way to get to safety than continuing on for another 7 minutes to get to there.
So Corcoran reran the escape route, only this time, instead of heading for the distant hills, he turned at the end of the first city block and made a dash into a four-story parkade building, a vertical evacuation.
Well, vertical evacuation was a good idea, it just didn't quite work. I got up two flights of the public parkade and I met this locked door here for the rest of the way. That's too bad.
But imagine a parkade like this, built to survive the quake and the wave, a public building with no locked doors so that people could easily get all the way to the top. The idea of vertical evacuation may turn out to be a vital new aspect of emergency planning on this coast.
Everywhere we go, well-engineered, reinforced concrete structure is standing. Even at the 2004 Great Indian Ocean tsunamis, right at the waterline, Banda Aceh, even though that the structure is completely inundated to the roofline, the structure itself is still standing. So our experience said that if you have a well-engineered concrete structures, I think those can be used for the tsunami shelters.
In Japan, where tsunamis are a much more common event, work has already been done to develop vertical evacuation shelters. Some are existing buildings where the public can gain easy access to the roof. Others, like the Nishiki Tower in the town of Taiki, are custom built to survive the effects of the earthquake, but are also hydrodynamically designed to withstand the forces of fast-moving water. Its unusual look, sort of like a lighthouse in the middle of town, causes people to ask questions.
If I see such kind of tower, I'm going to ask the people, what is this? So everybody will know that's the tsunami shelters. So I think this is a very important component.
There are no tsunami shelters like this in North America yet. Experiments are just getting started now to determine new building code requirements for shelters that can survive the quake, plus the pounding force of tsunami waves. At Oregon State University, Laboratory Director Dan Cox leads a group of guests and visiting scientists into the tsunami basin for a running of Cascadia's wave.
It's an idealization of Seaside. What you see in blue are some of the larger hotels and parking structures that are pretty close to where they are in real life. The red are idealized commercial structures, so the shops that are selling the t-shirts and food, that type of stuff. And then in yellow you see what would be a timber frame structure of residential houses. So what you're going to see next is roughly the equivalent of a 500-year event. So this is a 20-centimeter lab scale or 10-meter full-scale tsunami that is coming into Seaside. Hopefully with this type of project you can get a good sense of the scale, what that would mean if you're on the waterfront. The one thing that you notice though is a lot...
In a parallel experiment, Patrick Lynette of Texas A&M University has created a computer model that tries to reproduce exactly what's happening in the wave tank. If the wave tank and the computer model come out the same, then they can use the computer to predict what may happen in other towns where they can't afford to build a physical model like this.
What we're looking at here is momentum flux, which is a very good measure for the potential force of fluid for the tsunami as it comes in and it inundates Seaside.
Getting it right, all the tiny details of water moving over dry ground, cluttered with buildings and lumpy terrain, will push the limits of what a computer model can do.
The best computer models now are working hard at quantifying the flow around one or two objects, a cylinder, you know, a bridge piling, something like that, a relatively simple case, just because the computational time is enormous.
If you look at this little building right here, so let me pause. What actually happens is you get a wake off of this building. It bounces off the side of this building. And additionally, you get a large wake off of this building, and those two line up and just pound this tiny little building. And so what you'll see if you look at it, you'll see that dash of red shoot here and then bounce and then just eyeball right on this building. And it would be extremely damaging.
You sort of have to bootstrap between a physical model and a wave tank and a computer model to validate one against the other for the things that you can test, and then go beyond the capabilities of either one by using them together.
The model is built on a scale of 1 to 50. From a high angle like this, the waves may look a little underwhelming. But if you use a high-speed camera to slow the water down to the same scale as the buildings, and if you put a snorkel lens right at street level, you get a completely different perspective, remarkably similar to those home videos from Sumatra. toy cars, trucks, and buses are roughly the same scale as the model. In real life, the number of waterborne battering rams will increase with each new wave.
Very sobering. It was actually a shock. It took me more by surprise than I thought it would to watch the water roll through between those buildings and cascade over the buildings. So, it was very eye-opening, even though I've been dealing with it for a number of years.
I think it was fascinating to see how it would react on Seaside. Now, I think the nice thing about your toilet is we have some elevation to our community, so we have a better escape route and safety areas, but it was incredible to see the impact and to recognize just how inundated it can be.
If we could communicate that intensity to everyone, we might have a better chance at being prepared in these emergencies.
Hopefully we will be able to use that videotape or the simulations to maybe wake up some folks in the local area, show them, give them an idea of maybe really what to expect.
One of the things that I take away is that this decision about whether we stay or go during one of these events is a very critical decision, and it's one that we should be focusing on. Do we shelter in place, or do we focus on emergency exit? And the importance of debris. Vehicles and so on, floating in water, hitting buildings, hitting structures that may be providing safety.
A lot of these tourists could be a very large portion of the population in that inundation area. We'll have no clue.
If you suddenly felt the ground moving right now and you knew it was a big earthquake, what would you do?
I don't know, ask somebody else what we should do.
I think that I would be lucky that there wouldn't be an earthquake just when I am here.
I would head inland.
I would run for higher ground and take my baby as high as I could get him.
I don't know who I'd run to because there's a lot of lowland around here.
I don't know, you know, how it would affect you, how much in danger you would be.
I'd probably steal a car and hit higher ground.
Probably try to get to my vehicle to get out of here.
I'd try to save you guys, but if it didn't work out, I'd probably follow Tim.
Some local residents recall quite vividly the day when Seaside had its first tsunami false alarm.
It was an actual warning.
Wow.
People were headed up to the top. You couldn't get anywhere.
You'd be better off running up ahead than driving your car. You'd be better off abandoning your car and just walking.
There was so much traffic that nobody could go anywhere. It wouldn't matter if anything came. It was backed up on every street, everywhere. Nobody could go anywhere.
Why don't you just get a boat? Just sit in your boat. There.
I would swim.
The tsunami that hit the West Coast in 1964 was a relatively small disaster. Soldiers and civil defense teams arrived almost overnight. But what will happen when the big one hits? In the U.S., National Guard units have been sent to wars in the Middle East. In Canada, Army engineers have been moved east of the Rockies in a budget cut. Would they be able to get over the mountains, past the landslides, crumbled bridges, buckled roads, and airport runways? Who knows? People on the West Coast are realizing now they're going to be pretty much on their own when Cascadia's fault rips loose.
Don't expect somebody to come over the hill with a riding a white horse to be there the day after. It's just not going to happen.
This idea that somehow it's the federal government's responsibility to come in and save me, that doesn't work.
To me, the most awful feeling would be the moment after the earthquake going, I wish I would have paid more attention to what that guy said about where to go and what to do. So a little bit of preparedness now, I think, would put many people in that same position. Afraid of the earthquake, but not afraid of what to do or how to respond.
Most people here are going to survive a Cascadia event. But a Cascadia event is going to have more people having to be on their own and self-reliant and resilient for a longer period of time than any other event that I can think of.
Don't we as a society want to eventually save the community? That is, you want to have a community to return to. You want to have a hospital to go to. You want to have schools that your children can go to. You want to have teachers in those schools. All those things were wiped out in Sumatra. They lost everything. So that's a lesson that we should take away, is that we should be building our society so that it's resilient to the next tsunami.
It doesn't have to be such a disaster. It's only a disaster if we don't do something.
Well, thank you for joining us today. Very uplifted. Thankfully, we're also going to hear from the Water District, who has figured out how to solve this, to plan for these future events. So, thank you for bringing the presentation.
Chair Cowan and committee members, I thank you for taking the time to watch it and really take away exactly what was said there. We can't change the fact that an earthquake is going to happen. We can't change that. But we can plan and prepare for it, and we can take responsibility for ourselves. And the state can step up and we'll take responsibility where we can. And, you know, at your pleasure, I'd be happy to come back and go through what we're doing with the Tsunami Hazard Mitigation Program that's primarily funded by NOAA. We have a lot of activity and work we're doing. We work with OSU all the time. All that work that they're doing, both in the outreach and the research, gets folded into very practical, on-the-ground solutions that we work with all the time. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you may not have noticed, but Dr. Goldfinger was right behind me. He was in House Bill 2098, the C4 mapping, and I believe he'll be here next Tuesday to brief you folks a little bit more on some of the research that's going on. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any specific questions, Representative Eskin?
In the presentation, there was a comment made that we had an alert that was a false alert and everyone got congested. Mm-hmm. And the remark was you should just walk out of there rather than try to drive. What steps have we done to correct that?
Chair Cowan and Representative Esquivel, the alert that they were referring to occurred in June 2005 and it was a little bit of a hiccup between our tsunami warning centers. That we have one in Alaska that's a national, NOAA National Center, and then there's one in Hawaii, which is really the one that we listen to here on the coast for the Pacific. And there was a 7.2 magnitude earthquake off the coast of California. It wasn't a Cascadia. It was on a different fault system. It was a strike slip, so it didn't cause a tsunami. But there was a misunderstanding, and the alert went out. And most of the communities in Washington and in Oregon responded to it. And that was one of the responses were that was very telling. And as many of those folks said, what did they say they would do? They would jump in their car and they would drive away. And that is never, never the way to do it, because exactly what happens, everyone gets in their car and it gets congested. So the education and outreach that we do all the time is head for high ground on foot. Look for the signs. Every community on the state has signage that shows you which way to go for tsunami evacuation. It's very well signed. You have to look at them and you have to realize what they say. But the thing is, don't get in your car. The other thing we noted is several individuals headed to the beach because they wanted to watch it. And
so did the people in Southeast Asia there.
So that's been a long-standing challenge in our coastal communities.
Absolutely.
Is keeping the outsiders from wanting to come over to view the event.
And it's very true. I mean, the issue with the coastal communities is not as much a lot of the local folks that are there that have heard this. It is, you have so many visitors at certain times, well, almost all times of the year, there are people there. So they are from Pendleton. And so you ask people in Pendleton, do we need to know about tsunamis? Well, why? I live in Pendleton. Well, you probably spend part of your spring break in Cannon Beach. So it's a statewide issue.
We have, in our community, the signs, the stop signs in throughout the area are marked with red and green, or red and blue markings
right.
On the poles that indicate if it's red, you're still not out of the zone. If you get to the blue ones, you're
okay.
You're out of the... assuming those are accurate once we get our new... seafloor mapping, and we'll update
right.
the blue and red strips. But Representative Boone, how did that committee go after I left?
We heard from several people, plus Dr. Goldfinger, and he was still going when I came back here.
Oh, okay.
But we important to note, Dr. McConnell, that Representative Jensen from Pendleton knows how important it is.
Right. That's it. And Chair Callan and Representative Boone, yes, he gets it.
Yeah.
Yes. Right.
Well, thank you very much for being here. Maybe just before you leave, and we will, of course, be updated on how that other bill is progressing.
Yes.
We'll see when we're able to bring Professor Goldfinger back for more
right.
information. We've now figured out we're going to be on a fairly tight timeline for
right.
the next few meetings that we need to process the Senate bills in a specific timeline, but then we're going to have another couple days that will be available to us for information.
Right.
So we'll maybe talk with you and see what more this committee needs to hear this
session. Chair Carroll, that would be great. One final thing. They were talking a lot about vertical evacuation, and we are looking into that. There will be a workshop in the fall. There will be a national workshop. We'll bring in folks from British Columbia and actually visitors from Japan to look at what we would need to do to start designing for vertical evacuation for some of these communities.
Great. Thank you very much for being here today. And now we would like to move to an overview of some of the work that the Tualatin Valley Water District has done, and I understand you folks have taken some innovative steps in planning. I've tried to make sure that we reserved a half an hour for your presentation. Is that going to work for
That'll
you?
That'll be fine.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Chair Cowan, members of the committee, I'm Mark Knudsen. I'm the chief engineer with the Tualatin Valley Water District. Joining me today is Peter Boone. He's an engineering associate with the district, and Neil Kennedy, who is he's got a mouthful of a title, security risk and emergency coordinator, and I don't think I got that quite right, but it's close. Folks, I can tell you that our presentation today will lack the production value of the two previous videos that you've seen, just so you're prepared and hopefully not disappointed. But I think our message is just as important, if not more so, because the fact of the matter is recovery following one of these events can't happen until the community is assured a safe and reliable supply of potable drinking water. And that's what we do every day, and that's why we've taken the issue of emergency planning, emergency management, and frankly, seismic planning so seriously in what it is that we do. So if we could bring up the presentation.
And Peter, thank you for joining us. I understand there just might be a little connectivity to this committee between this panel. And
I was going to point that out for those of you who didn't catch his name. This is my son, Peter, my perfect son.
and we're
glad that you could all come. I'm glad you could come, Mark. Mark's on jury duty this week, and fortunately didn't have to go today. So, and Neil, I've seen this presentation. This is the dynamic trio.
Okay.
So what we want to do today, if you could get to the next slide, is I will quickly cover the general stuff in terms of a little bit of background about the Tualatin Valley Water District and where we are and what we do. And then I'll turn it over to Neil, who will discuss emergency preparedness and disaster planning at the district and how we approach that and some of the considerations that go into that. Peter's going to talk some about what work we've done in terms of seismic upgrades of our facilities and how we approach that issue, and then it'll bring back to me to wrap it up and talk about what it means to us. So a little bit about the Tualatin Valley Water District. This is a map of water providers in the Portland metropolitan area. TVWD is the green area here. We also have a service area down here between Portland and Tigard. We serve about 200,000 people in western or eastern Washington County. Our system includes about 750 miles of pipelines. We have several significant, although our service area is largely residential, we're obviously a mostly bedroom community to Portland and Beaverton, the fact of the matter is we also include Regional Medical Center, St. Vincent's Hospital, Nike's World Headquarters is in our service area, and one of the largest Intel fabs is in our service area. And so we have a significant industrial element as well as residential, and the fact of the matter is that what we do has a significant impact on the economic climate within the Portland area. If we could get to the next slide. We have two primary sources of supply. Our Board of Commissioners has taken the issue of seismic preparedness, emergency preparedness, very seriously, and so we actually have two sources of supply. One comes from the east, from the city of Portland and the Bull Run Supply and the Columbia South Shore well field, which has redundancy built into it. And then our second source of supply is the Joint Water Commission, our Trask-Tualatin system that starts as Henry Hague Lake or Scoggins Reservoir in western Washington County. Both those supplies are piped in, and so we actually have a dual feed, one from each side of the system with the ability to really exist quite well on either one of those supplies. And so a fair amount of redundancy built into it. And again, our commissioners have really made that commitment to have that redundancy and achieve that multiple source of supply. In addition, we're currently in the process of upgrading the Western supply, the Joint Water Commission supply, to increase the capacity so that it ultimately it has the ability to serve our entire service area. Right now, we can serve either from either source on our winter day demands, but the fact of the matter is we believe it's appropriate that one of those sources is able to carry the load for peak summer demands as well. So with that, that's just a very quick snippet of the Tualatin Valley Water District. I'll turn it over to Neil, and he can talk about emergency and disaster planning.
Thank you, Mark. Tualatin Valley Water District has been engaged in emergency preparedness planning for a number of years now. Some of those initiatives are the hiring of dedicated staff for planning and preparation, which would be my position. They've also made the decision to institutionalize the incident command system. It's something that we train and practice in regularly. We also have a number of regional partnerships and mutual aid agreements. Some of those were existing regional partnerships that we've expanded their role and used them for an emergency preparedness standpoint where they weren't there before. And in the area of mutual aid agreements, some of those were newly created, and I'll talk about those in a minute. We also participate in annual exercises and the ongoing inspection and maintenance of our facilities to make sure that no deferred maintenance catches up with us. So those regional partnerships are the Regional Water Providers Consortium. It's a consortium of 23 water providers in the Portland metro area, and included in there is an emergency planning committee. We also work closely with the Washington County Office of Consolidated Emergency Management, which is the emergency management role office in Washington County. We are active in the Oregon Water and Wastewater Agency Response Network. We participate with InfraGuard, which is a group of infrastructure owners that have come together working with the FBI as a sponsor to work on infrastructure resiliency and security. And we're a member of the Urban Area Security Initiative, the Public Works Working Group, which not only provides a conduit to the federal funding stream for urban area security grant monies, but also is an area where we can work for cross-discipline regional planning. In the Regional Water Providers Emergency Planning Committee, it's an idea, it's a forum for face-to-face meeting with the emergency managers and the folks responsible for emergency operations in the various water providers. We share programs, liberally borrow from each other, and have had a chance to pursue grants as a regional water infrastructure. One of those currently underway is the Intertie study. In our systems, they touch each other at the peripheries, but the peripheries tend to be small diameter and not very useful for moving large quantities of water. And if one provider were to experience a large disruption, if the interties were of a larger size, we could probably move a more sizable quantity of water. And so that study is underway now. And we've also been able to get funding for the emergency water distribution systems. The Consolidated Office of Emergency Management allows us to meet with local emergency managers from throughout Washington County. It allows us to discuss planning and make sure that our plans will flow with one another. The worst cases are plans that are made in a vacuum, and we never assess them against one another to find out how they will actually work. We have a strong partnership with that emergency management staff and with the EOC, and this is reinforced during our exercise play. I talked about the plan relationships, and we also have mutual aid support from the Office of Emergency Management. They have the Washington County Co-op. It started as an equipment lending program, but it was very broadly written, and it has actually been used more as a mutual aid compact. The WARN initiatives are a nationwide initiative in the water and wastewater industry to provide a peer-to-peer emergency response network. Oregon was the fifth state in the nation to come online with an active compact, and now there are, I think, 45 states that are active members. This is currently an intrastate agreement. It allows for peer-to-peer response. It does not require a declaration from county, state, or federal level to enact it. As soon as one of the member agencies feels that they are overwhelmed and can no longer respond, they can activate it and bring their peers' resources to bear. During the inception of this, we partnered with the Office of Emergency Management, Department of Health Services, and DEQ. In fact, Ken Murphy has been the keynote speaker for the last two annual meetings, and DHS continues to support us by showing up to almost every board meeting. We're doing ongoing recruiting, and as I mentioned, TVWD was a founding member. It was successfully used in the January snowstorms in 2008. City of Detroit was inundated, and it was a somewhat non-traditional role. It wasn't specifically the water infrastructure that was in danger, except for the fact that the water treatment plant was operating on backup power, and they could no longer plow their roads. And the City of Salem was able to respond with snow removal equipment, front loaders and dump trucks, and dig their way into the treatment plant so that fuel could be delivered. We conduct annual exercises. TVWD works with numerous partners, whether that be the other providers in the area or its partners, its non-water partners in Washington County. We've done a number of different exercises recently dealing with either intentional contamination, accidental contamination, loss of one or both sources. And in the most recent one, we participated in the statewide Cascadia Peril exercise. Obviously, seismic events could have a massive impact on water systems. Some of those would be loss of treatment, storage, and the ability to deliver it. that goes pretty quickly. Potential damage to the distribution system means that not only do we not have the ability to transit it to the homes, the loss of potable water there for drinking, for cooking, for cleaning, you also lose water for sanitation, and we lose the ability to suppress fires in an urban area that may be suffering from gas-fueled fires from ruptured infrastructure on their side. And obviously, it's a sealed system, and when we have ruptures, we have the possible for contamination. Really, recovery can't begin. Any long-term recovery cannot begin without potable water. Through federal grant funds, we've been able to fund a number of these emergency water distribution systems. What you're looking at here is a manifold table. I think there are six taps on it. We fill six-quart bags. We can fill six bags in under 30 seconds and set up distribution points to be able to hand these out to the community. These require that we have potable water, but if the reservoirs have survived, we can move the water via tanker to the distribution point and begin to hand it out to the community. If there is somewhat less damage and we can still find a hydrant in an area that's pressurized and has water flowing to it, then we can run it directly off of a hydrant as well. The beautiful thing about this system is that we're in the process of putting together 9 of them currently in the Portland metro area, and there are 11 more that are used in Seattle. They're all exactly the same. They require the same training, care, and maintenance.
Pete. I'm Peter Boone. I'll speak to the seismic upgrades that we're undertaking right now. And Dr. McConnell spoke on this, and her presentation showed this Cascadia subduction earthquake scenario, that could cause a tsunami on the coast. Well, it can also cause damage to our system and any water system in the affected area. And one of the vulnerabilities that we have are our reservoirs, and certainly our above-ground steel reservoirs. And think about a glass of water that maybe is sitting on your desk and is just held there by gravity. It's fine. It's stable until you kick the table, and then it can either tip over or, in a worst case, split open. And we have the same vulnerability with our steel reservoirs that were built, 40, 50 years ago under lesser non-existent seismic codes. So what we do is first assess those vulnerabilities, figure out which reservoirs may be vulnerable to damage in a seismic event, and then we'll go in and add a sturdy concrete foundation and physically tie that reservoir to the foundation. And you can see this in the first slide. Here's a 50-year-old reservoir that was basically, use that analogy of your water cup sitting on your desk. It's just sitting on a concrete pad. And here's a reservoir where we've gone in and retrofitted a sturdy concrete foundation with steel anchor chairs welded onto the tank. In addition to reservoirs being vulnerable, the pipes connected to that reservoir can also become separated in a seismic event. So we overcome that challenge with flexible connections that are allowed to have some differential movement during the event. And as Mark spoke to, we just try to design redundancy into the distribution system, and that way we're able to, if we do have a problem in one area of the district, we're able to close some valves and reroute the water and provide service to the remainder of the area. One of the issues, if there was a failure in our water system during a seismic event, many more people would be affected, whereas if their home is in good shape, if it didn't collapse during the event, if their water goes off, then all of a sudden they're affected and the widespread reach becomes more pronounced. And earlier we saw information from our communication providers. They're a big part of our system as well because we're able to remotely monitor and operate our system through a system called SCADA, which basically allows us to operate valves and monitor water levels. So it's important for them to have their system up and running as fast as possible after an event as well. And I believe Mark will continue.
Well, we took it your word, trying to keep it short, sweet, and to the point. So I'll wrap it up by basically pointing out that our approach to emergency planning, emergency management, I like to think of as really a three-legged stool. the first critical element is really the preparation and planning. It's the communication. It's participating in the exercises that Neil talked about and really testing our systems to understand what's going to work and, frankly, what's not going to work. And there's probably going to be a lot that won't work. But to really begin to understand those so we can prepare and make adjustments accordingly. The second is really through regional and, frankly, national relationships and partnerships. Neil spoke to the OrWARN network. We are, frankly, as things go, we aren't a real big public utility. If we have an event like what we've seen in the previous video, our resources will very quickly be overwhelmed in our ability to provide our day-to-day service and begin to facilitate any kind of response. And so it's important that we have relationships with other water providers outside of our immediate region, both in eastern Oregon, but frankly throughout the United States, as was shown in Hurricane Katrina and other major events. It's really folks from outside the immediate area that provide the response that begins to set the stage for that recovery process, which can literally take years. And then the third leg to that stool is really upgrading our infrastructure, analyzing where our vulnerabilities are, and then making investments in that infrastructure, be it through our water tanks. We just recently completed a significant evaluation study of one of our water treatment plants to look at how is the water treatment plant going to respond as we bring in water and this event occurs. Will it be there to be able to produce safe, reliable water after the event, or are we going to have to rely on the National Guard that may or may not be there? And then to take that forward and make investments in terms of our capital improvement plan and upgrade those structures so that they are able to resist at least the most likely events. So that's really our approach. Again, if you had to think of one thing, it's really the three-legged stool. We take it in three different directions and try to do our best to have that balanced approach. With that, we'd be more than happy. Neil would be more than happy to answer any questions you might have.
Well, I thank you, gentlemen, for coming today. I think that it's very helpful as we think about the potential that's out there that we recognize that some of our utility providers and our, you're right, water is critical to all of our recovery efforts. And it's helpful to know that you're taking steps to be ready to be back up and running quickly. So I think that's a kind of a nice way to pull it all together. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you tell us where you get these tables, the water distribution table? Because I see those as being something other communities could have on hand.
Yeah. Chair Cowan and Representative Boone, these are actually provided by a company called Ryan Herco Flow Solutions. This is not their normal line of business. They do liquid conveyance for industrial applications. They just happen to use food-grade materials for some of those applications, and they were willing to take on the challenge of designing this. The system was originally done in partnership with Seattle Public Utilities, and we took the idea and ran with it shortly after that. I do want to stress that this isn't a silver bullet kind of solution. They put out only a little bit of water. We can do 6 quarts times 6 taps every 30 seconds. We're limited with how much water we can bring to the distribution point, and it has to be potable. We don't have a way to treat it. And so it really relies on what Peter was saying about the resiliency of the reservoir. The reservoir has to survive so that then we have a cistern of water that we can draw from. But in the right usage, it's the right tool. And it gives us a way to use a resource that we already own and get it out and start serving the community while the operations folks go back and start restoring the system.
So can you send us that information to David, or he can get it to me?
Absolutely.
So basically these systems would provide drinking water for people.
Yes, ma'am.
A quart at a...
6 quarts at a time, we would hand them out.
That's not going to do everything, but that's going to keep folks in drinking water.
Absolutely.
Right. Representative Mathis.
I had a question on that line, too, so thanks for bringing that question forward. It says hooked to a tanker or a hydrant, but yet you can't treat this water. Is that right?
Well, Chair Cowan, and I'm sorry, please.
No, that's fine. I'm just picturing being a firefighter. We're called out to fill a lot of dunk tanks for, you know, charity events, and we always look at the water and think, glad we're not the ones jumping in that. So
yeah.
I'm just kind of curious.
That's good information.
Next time you're asked to be in one of those,
that's
for the benefits,
well, I have a reason.
But so you can't treat that water from the hydrant. There's no way to.
Do you want to take that?
Sure. Chair Cowan, Representative Matthews, sort of. There are various degrees of treatment. The fact of the matter is there are small portable units that we can marry with these tables to be able to provide, again, these fairly limited quantities. Now, when you put that kind of treatment device into a system like this, the production is going to suffer. Now you've reduced the amount, but the good news is it's safe. Alternatively, you can at least disinfect it through things like iodine tablets or provide chlorination. Aesthetically, it may not be great, but the fact of the matter is we can at least assure that biologically the water is safe. Mm-hmm. I want to add one of the other biggest dilemmas that we deal with in this kind of situation is how do we deal with the water in the tanks? As a fire responder, you can appreciate that there's a lot of interest in keeping those tanks open and making that water available to deal with the fires that undoubtedly result from the event. But the fact of the matter is we also have an interest in closing them down, shutting them off, so that there's a reservoir of safe water that is available to us. And so part of the challenge that we've had to deal with from an infrastructure standpoint is, well, which do you do? Do you let it feed the system to put out fires, or do you shut it down? And we've sort of taken a compromise approach, at least where we have twin tanks, is to think in terms of, well, one of those tanks we're going to sacrifice for firefighting, one of those tanks we're going to think about closing that thing down as quickly as we can, to the point where, although we don't have them yet, there are manufactured devices of earthquake valves that actually have seismic sensor, and when that sensor goes off, it closes the valve and preserves the contents of the tank. So it's sort of a double-edged sword in terms of how you respond to storage.
Representative Widener.
Just one real quick question. Madam Chair, this is more on the lines of water source, because I saw you had Hag Lake up there. Now, Hag Lake's strictly for irrigation, correct?
No.
No?
No. If I could explain, Hag Lake is actually a U.S. Bureau of Reclamation facility, and part of the original agreement associated with that basically creates multiple uses. About 50% of the capacity goes to irrigation in Washington County, and the other 50% of the capacity goes to municipal and industrial production, M&I water, largely through the Joint Water Commission that serves the city of Forest Grove, the city of Hillsborough, the Tualatin Valley Water District, and the city of Beaverton. And so that whole area of Washington County relies heavily on Hag Lake, the Scoggins Project.
So not for drinking water, then?
For drinking water, yes.
There's
a water treatment plant in Forest Grove that takes water from the project, treats it to potable water standards, and then transmission system that delivers it clear through to the city of Beaverton.
There are also a lot of water skiers who drink a little bit of that lake.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to touch that one, but Chair.
Yeah, well, I've been there. You mentioned that Ken Murphy was speaker at a number of your conferences. So I'm assuming there's conversation along these lines going on between water districts throughout the state. Are others taking similar efforts in the disaster planning?
Go ahead, Neil.
Or are you going to supply all of our water for us?
Well, we'd love to be able to, excuse me, Madam Chair, we'd love to be able to supply all of your water. Unfortunately, I don't think that that's realistic. The initiative with The Oregon WARN system has been to, and we've only been in existence for 2 years now, and so it's been to recruit as heavily as we can to bring everybody on board so that they're all members. It satisfies one of the requirements for NIMS compliance, which is to have pre-existing agreements for mutual aid, and so that's one of the key points that we use in trying to recruit folks. In fact, later this afternoon, I'm headed down to Grants Pass on a recruiting trip. So we're trying to get more penetration in the southern part of the state. But really, we know that if we had this type of event and there was massive damage, even if it was a crustal fault, something in the metropolitan area, that it's going to take, you know, the way we say it is, two guys in a truck from every utility in the rest of the state to come on up to be able to start to rebuild us, because we're going to be busy with, unfortunately, personal issues and family and houses and those kinds of things. And so if we can get little bits and pieces from every small utility to come up there and assist, then we'll be a lot better off. The second piece of that is that the WARN initiative nationwide has used a single agreement with very little change from state to state. The idea behind that was that at some point, hopefully legislation would change and that we would be able to go interstate with it. And so if I had to respond my crews into Idaho to help with something, we already have an agreement that is very similar, and hopefully the attorneys won't wrangle too much over it and we can get help to people that need help. And the same would go the other direction.
Okay. Well, we thank you very much for bringing the presentation to us. I think we're about to get the hook here for our committee. So.
No problem. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Matt, is there any other business before the committee? We're still wrestling a little bit to see whether there is a presentation that's timely for us to have on Thursday or not, so stay tuned. We'll decide soon whether that's going to happen or not. So, thank you, committee. With that, we are adjourned.